is John McMullen broadcasting from North Wildwood, New Jersey?
He's spending the evening here before returning home.
Yesterday, President Donald Trump took the United States out of the Paris Accords, and I'm sure he was surprised at how rapidly the criticism came in. One of the newspaper articles said he was both annoyed and befuddled, or irritated and befuddled at the criticism from the French president. Well, since then, the governments of Germany and Italy and France together have attacked his action, and DeVol says that, the contrary to what he said that he will renegotiate, there will be no renegotiation. There is an agreement between 100 and some odd, I believe it's 138 nations, that have signed this. And if you renegotiate with one country, you're faced with having to renegotiate with them all. Well, since then, Governor Jerry Brown of California has come out against the agreement, and coincidentally, he happened to be leaving for China today to talk about a agreement with China, both in manufacturing and to adhere to the client the agreement. Today, ex-mayor of New York,
as people might have figured out, that was something that was left over from our 2-week vacation that should never have played. Now, obviously, that we're a little behind and get everything all squared away again in the control studios. So now we'll go to Henry Mancini.
Peter Gunn.
That's right, Peter Gunn. Now we're back to normal. It's Sunday night. And that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack's son, welcoming to 193rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to the recordings of the previous 192 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is JohnMack. So that's www.johnmack13.com. And you'll find the links under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe. It's free and there's only one email per day. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, either live or as most do, to listen later. Now, to this week's show, the 193rd, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guests. My guest tonight is writer, editor, technical writer, cat lover, and Trump resistor, Patricia Washburn. Before beginning our discussion, I must thank Patricia for coming on the show on very short notice. I had planned to have Patricia to be on later in the summer, but at the last minute, my schedule guests had an emergency and had to reschedule, and Patricia graciously agreed to fill in. Good evening, Patricia. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I grew up in a town called South Dartmouth, Massachusetts, which is listed in the Preppy Handbook as a preppy place to be.
And you went to grammar school there?
Yeah, I went to school in Dartmouth and went to their high school. We had a championship marching band, and one of the big experiences of my high school years was we got to play at the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid. I was 13 years old.
It was the 1980 Olympics, wasn't it, that it was the Miracle on Ice?
Yep, absolutely.
It was
terrific. It was a big moment. Yeah. I didn't get to
see
the hockey game. So
do you remember what your first aspirations were growing up?
I started writing. I taught myself to read before I was four. I wrote my first poem when I was four. I rhymed horse with of course. So I'm going to say that writing always had something to do with it. At various times I wanted to be, okay, you're growing up in a preppy town, right? You want to be a lawyer, you want to be a stockbroker, you want to be something prestigious like all your friends' daddies or whatever.
Did you write for your school paper? Well, what, a yearbook or a local paper?
I was the editor of the school paper. And then when I was 19, I got a job at the New Bedford, Massachusetts paper, the Standard Times. I was a part-time copy editor on the weekends while I was in college.
Then where'd you go to college?
Princeton University. I had grown up in this very suburban environment, and I wanted to experience something different, and I certainly did. I lived in a high-rise dorm with the subway running, the trolley cars running right outside, and it was a very different experience, and I really enjoyed it. I liked being in a more diverse place.
But you went home on the weekends to work on the paper?
Yep. I didn't have much of a social life in college, but boy, I came out with some career skills and I got paid, which just made me so happy. And I found my people, newspaper people. It turned out that newspapers were where smart people who cared about words went to work. And so I realized that I belonged I in a way that I had never felt before.
Then after graduation, then what?
I got a job through one of my professors at a paper in Framingham, Massachusetts. It's now called the Metro West Daily News. It was called the Middlesex News then, which is the name of the county. Since the job involved me working overnight and weekends, my colleagues and I often referred to it as the Littlesex News because that's what we were getting. But I spent 2 years there and I really bonded with those people, and we still have a Facebook group for people who used to work there and remember the time such and such a thing happened. There's a tradition in the news industry that when somebody leaves the paper, your coworkers make up a fake front page full of satirical stories about you. And I still have my goodbye page from the Middlesex News.
You described yourself professionally as a journalist, book writer, editor, technical writer, and programmer. That's a wide umbrella. Let's take them one by one. Tell us about your journalism career.
I was never a reporter. I was always a copy editor. I did some after a couple of years in the Framingham paper, I moved to Portland, Maine to take a job at the paper here, and I really liked Maine, so I stayed. The business changed a lot, and in 1995, I was the person on the night desk who could fix the computer in the middle of the night so we didn't have to call the computer guy. And so that was enough to get you a job on the internet in those days. So I became the paper's first web producer. I think I was the first full-time web news person in the state of Maine. And so that involved a whole lot of learning and growing and exploring new technologies. And now people ask me, how do you get a job in the web industry? And I'm like, I don't know, because I was just in the right place at the right time.
But let's go on to the book that you wrote on Dernalius. How did you get involved and interested in the subject, and why the pseudonym?
I was still working in journalism when I began writing books for Wiccans and Pagans. I had become interested in the religion some years previously through some friends, and after spending some time exploring and being involved with that, I was able to pitch some books to a publisher. Back then, pre-internet and in the early days of the internet, Wicca and paganism were religions that were not as acceptable as they are today. I mean, there are still plenty of people who disapprove, but it's nowhere near what it used to be. And I think there's a lot of sort of acceptance that were mostly harmless. And so I was still working as a journalist, so I published my books under a pseudonym, Jane Rayburn. And after three books, I wrote one, co-wrote another, and then edited a poetry anthology, which I think is how I met you originally. And after that, I realized that writing for a religious audience of a small niche religion was not really a paying proposition. And in the meantime, a group of people that had done a lot of communicating through books and meeting one another in the metaphysical aisle of Barnes and Noble or whatever was turning to the internet, and we were finding each other that way and building community in different ways than we used to.
Now, you mentioned three books and Cora, another one. Were they all under the pseudonym name, and were they all dealing with paganism?
First one was called Celtic Wicca, and basically it was an attempt to tackle a subject that is fairly controversial in some circles, which is the idea that you could build a Wiccan religious path, which is a modern religion invented in the early 20th century, that harkens back to ancient Celtic history. Some people have tried to do this by claiming that whatever they were doing was what the ancient Celts would have done, and that is just not true. But you can do that in a way that is respectful of history. At least that was my thesis, and I wrote a book about it. The second book I worked on was called Building a Magical Relationship. I worked with Cynthia Collins, who is a Wiccan therapist, and we did a relationship manual around this idea, this set of religious paths. And the idea was that there are a lot of relationship manuals out there that are very Christian or Judeo-Christian in their orientation, and this was an alternative. And then I edited a poetry anthology for Pagans, which is a wonderful, fun project. It was called The Pagan's Muse. Unfortunately, it didn't sell very well because the company was going through some stuff at the time, but I'm still really proud of it, and there's still some really amazing poetry in there. So if you find a copy, go get The Pagan's Muse, because I didn't write that part that myself. A lot of other really talented people did.
Have you maintained your interest in Celtic religion and paganism?
Yes, absolutely. Up until about 9 years ago, I co-ran a group in Southern Maine with my then husband. In the last few years, I have been less active, partly because the marriage ended, and partly because I have become increasingly disabled, but I still consider myself a pagan and still turn to that religious path for my inspiration in various areas.
On the tangent, give me another answer to this. It's my understanding that the only place in North America that the Celtic language is spoken is on Nova Scotia, Grand.
Right, in the Maritimes. Yep.
Right, and They used
and
to
they
have
also have
every...
a strong Celtic music tradition up there, and that's some really gorgeous stuff.
They used to have every year at the same time both the festival and the technology festival. I remember that a friend of mine, Esther Dyson, had spoken there years ago. I wonder if they still do that during August.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up.
Okay. Now,
you can get a ferry from here. I'm in Portland, Maine. You can get a ferry from here over to the Maritimes.
It's Cape Breton Island, I believe, right?
Cape Breton, yep.
Yep. Okay. Now, do you write poetry yourself also?
Very rarely. I tend to appreciate it more than write it. My writing, I tend to be somebody these days who writes for money. So I will write what people pay me to write, which is, you know, largely software manuals and some very not terribly inspiring stuff. And then that fuels my writing in areas that are closer to my heart, which these days is political writing.
Yeah, I had...
Go ahead. Well, I was a journalism major, and, you know, that degree is appropriately called a BS. But I help write emails for various groups that I'm involved with politically. And right now I'm doing some editing for a friend who has written a novel, and I'm writing for a trade magazine that covers the construction of high-tech education and health spaces. It's weirdly fascinating.
I was an English major, and I after college when I wound up through a quirk in technology where I spent all my career, and it got me into writing, into teaching as well as consulting. And not only didn't I write poetry, I never read a poem until about 10 years ago, when I happened to be walking through Barnes & Noble and I saw the title of a book by Charles Bukowski that seems so wild that I have to look at this book. And I decided in reading it that he's crazy and I can probably do this too. Then that got me writing poetry.
That's
but
great.
I mean, it's interesting how things turn. You also, and I guess this is coming from your internet experience early. You've done software documentation, technical writing.
Mm-hmm.
What sparked that? Had you, in addition to the internet, had you gotten into other computer experience? And
I completed about 3/4 of a master's degree in computer science. And specifically, I did that to improve. I could see myself getting more and more disabled. I needed to be able to improve my chances of getting jobs that I could do from home. And I found it interesting. And I am now about to finish a master's in cybersecurity at Southern New Hampshire University. And again, I find it really interesting, but there's also a career angle to it. And I am working as a technical writer for a Fortune 500 company, JLL, and I write software training and what they call support knowledge. When you call the help desk, the person who answers the phone calls up a document in a database to give you your answer. That was the stuff I'm writing, or I have written.
You mentioned that you've also done some computer programming. That must also relate to this. Have you gotten into database use and to various languages, or explain what you've been doing there?
Yeah, mostly I have done stuff around the web. My driving passion is communicating, is getting information out to people. One of the ways we do that now is through databases. And so most of what I've done has been web-oriented, has been focused on what they call the front end, the part that delivers information rather than the back end, the part that manages servers and systems. I know what some of that stuff, but I'm certainly not an expert.
What tools have you used?
What I mostly use is PHP. And I just write a lot of times I find it faster just to write in text. I mean, I'm a writer. I type really fast. And I've certainly used some programming tools, but it was mostly for classes where I was required to use them. So I've used Eclipse and Visual Studio and so on. Most of the time, what I'm doing is not complex enough to need that.
You mentioned the masters in cybersecurity. What moved you from strict computer science to cybersecurity, and take me through some of the courses there and to what you hope to do with it?
I've been I got interested through a very good teacher in my former master's program, which unfortunately fell apart because the University of Southern Maine had such serious budget cuts that they laid off tenured faculty. It was a mess. But there was this guy who was really good in cybersecurity, and he was really fascinating, and he had all these great stories. And I guess the power of story compels me. But I also started feeling like there was a niche for me there. And this was well before the last election cycle. I started thinking, I bet it would be an interesting challenge to work on cybersecurity guidelines for political campaigns. So that's still where I'm headed. And that may involve getting some consulting gigs. It may position me for a job as an analyst, or it may just be something I do as a service to the political world. I don't know. But that's what I'm going to be doing this fall.
It's interesting. You mentioned the school falling apart in Southern Maine. A friend of mine lives in New Hampshire, and he went just the opposite route. He was a computer professional, and apparently, I know another fellow that's made use of this. That if you're on Medicare, or if you're on Social Security, that you're entitled to free college courses from the University of New Hampshire. And my friend got a master's in fine arts. He's moving into writing, so he got an MFA. My other friend, after his wife got sick and was passing away, he dropped out after two semesters. But apparently, if you're in the master's program, the most you can take for the first year is two courses per semester, because they want to see if you're serious. But then after that, you can carry a full graduate schedule or full undergrad schedule. I think that's terrific. And we normally think of New Hampshire as an extremely conservative state.
I not, wish things were different here in Maine, but I'm actually going to an online program run through Southern New Hampshire University, which is a private nonprofit institution out of Manchester.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's all online, and they offer discounts for active duty military. So sometimes my classmates are in Kuwait or Afghanistan or Germany. It's great.
And did you get credit for your computer science courses?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, I was. I.
It's going to take me a little over a year to finish the master's degree.
I had started the master's at Iona College, where I graduated from, in business, and then I got extremely busy after just two semesters or three semesters at work, when I wound up being responsible for all the data processing functions of a major brokerage firm, and I dropped it, and then 25 years later, when I was teaching, I found that to continue teaching, that I would have had to have a master's. And so I was able still to get some credit for some of the Iona courses. And I wound up doing the master's in computer science. And then,
great,
because I was there all the time, and I liked hanging around there, because my wife became the director of academic computing, that I was teaching two courses after I got the master's. I then got the second master's in public administration and focusing on criminal justice. So I was able to put both of those together and then wind up teaching computer forensics and other things. So it's
cool.
Been an interesting time how you can get back in the swim after being away from it for a while.
This is going to be 30 years since my bachelor's degree. But I'm really enjoying learning, and you know, it sounds like you are like me in that regard, that you know, learning is awesome. Bring me some more of it.
Yes. So when are you going to do the PhD?
We'll see. We'll see what I need to do. I don't know. I mean, I'm disabled enough that I have to do an all online program. I don't know if they're doing PhDs that way now. I expect they are, but I haven't looked into it.
Yeah, the Walden University is. Now, I don't know if there's any residency at all, but I explored that a number of years ago. And I'm not sure if there was any residency, but they definitely had the PhD in management systems and in computer science. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a few times your disability. If you're comfortable talking about it, would you explain it to us about the origins and the restrictions that it places on you?
Sure. I have a hereditary fat disorder called lipedema, and it occurs almost exclusively in women. And if you see a woman with thick columnar legs and a larger lower body than upper body, she probably has it. It's also quite likely that she doesn't know it, because a lot of times a woman with this condition goes to a doctor and she gets told, oh, you need to lose weight. Well, the problem is if you have lipedema, you can't lose the weight. And so you get into the cycle of dieting and exercising and beating yourself up and not seeing your legs get any smaller. It sets in at puberty. So I have had this since I was 11. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 40. At that point, I realized that my late mother had had it. And I also was able to communicate then to my sister that she probably had it, which it turned out she did. And it progresses. It gets worse at pregnancy, which I never had any, or at perimenopause, which is difficult to avoid if you're female. I am 52, so I am into menopause. I have been getting progressively worse for the last 10 years or so, meaning that I have been getting fatter. I have been unable to lose weight. I am experiencing chronic pain. I experience frequent and sometimes acute infections in my legs, because the skin is being asked to cover more ground than it's supposed to. I also have joint pain because physics works and my body is carrying around more weight than it was designed to. And there's not a lot you can do in terms of treatment. There is surgery available for people at earlier stages, but by the time it came to this country in 2014, I was already too far advanced for it to be useful for me. Why do I talk about this? Because it's not my favorite part of my life, because my mother went to her grave thinking that it was her fault she couldn't lose the weight. I don't want anybody else to feel that way. She self-medicated with alcohol and tobacco for the chronic pain with predictable results. She died when she was quite young. She was 51. I was 15 and was not at all ready to lose my mom. So that's my little speech about lipedema. I deliver that whenever I can, because I hope that I can save someone else from going through what she did.
Now, what does the operation do for those people that can have it? Where do they operate? On the legs, or okay. And
we don't have a lot of long-term data on its success. It does make the legs smaller. It's basically a plastic surgery technique that removes fat.
Okay.
And
now, does it then come back? I mean, does it regenerate or?
Well, that's my question, and I haven't seen enough data to know, you know, even if it is something I would recommend to a younger woman with this issue. I know that it's not an option for me, so I haven't looked into it in detail.
Why would it not be an option for you if it's a plastic surgery type thing?
Because I am too far advanced, and also and the other factor, of course, is that it's still considered experimental and insurance doesn't cover it. And even if I had $50,000 I wasn't doing anything with, I think I would spend it on something more fun, like a world tour.
Okay. And when you mentioned there's some pain, is there anything that deals with pain that's not addicting or anything that's helpful?
I have stayed off of opioids because I just don't want to go down that road for obvious reasons. One of the things that helps me is putting my legs up for a while in the afternoon. So I take a nap every day. I'm lucky. I have a job that lets me do that. I still put in my hours at work, but I take this break in the middle of the day and lie down. I work from home and I can do that. Another thing that helps is they have recently legalized marijuana in my state. And I, for the first time in my life, because I was a good little girl, let me tell you, I have begun experimenting with certain products in that family and have had some success with that. I try not to do it very often, usually just on the weekends, not when I'm working, but it does help.
Now, we normally think of cybersecurity work as working out of a government office or corporate office. If you mm-hmm. want to concentrate and if your mobility is limited, will you be able to do it from home or is it consulting work? What do you want to write about it?
As I explore the field more fully, where I see myself fitting in is in the area of cybersecurity awareness programs. And I've actually done some work on this in the organization that I already work for. We did a fake phishing email. And I wrote some of the communications around that went out to employees. The email that said, hey, you got phished because you clicked on this link, or hey, you didn't get phished because you didn't click on the link. Good job. And the emails that said, an article for the company newsletter about the test that said, you know, okay, 30% of us clicked on this. How about we all go refresh our memories on the security awareness training? So trying to engage people with the idea that this is important and that you need to know it without scaring them or making them feel bad if they did click on the link. And I think that's an area that I can, you know, I'm certainly not going to go head to head with the fancy bears of this world. but that's an area where I can use my communication skills and my knowledge of the security field to have a positive effect and to help protect an organization.
It would seem that anything in cybersecurity, if it's not, and it would be more important to you, is to constantly be educating yourself and to be current. Whereas very often, if you're in a corporate office and if you've got nine programs, then all you're interested in is protecting that particular office. Where if you're consulting, you're going to have to know everything that's current.
And I actually love educating myself. I think this stuff is fascinating. I may be a little odd, but I read up on cybersecurity stuff all the time just for fun, never mind for my program.
Have you looked at by any chance at the Brink newsletter, BRNK? Brink is Brink is a subsidiary of the Atlantic, and a previous guest on this show is the editor, Brock Meeks, and they usually have something on cybersecurity. The whole idea of Brink is as corporate intelligence, corporate information to what's going on. You know, we're at the brink of this, we're at the brink of that. You might take a look at it.
Thank you.
On a different topic, in the bizarre climate that we find ourselves in, you've described yourself as a resistor. What do you mean by that, and what have you done in this area?
I've always been sort of left-leaning. You know, growing up in Massachusetts, it was tough to avoid, although I do not I will never hate Republicans because my beloved dad, happy Father's Day, was a moderate Republican. He believed in women's reproductive choice. He had gay friends. He had black friends. So he didn't like the social agenda that has taken control. He just wanted the government to spend less money. And he was a super kind, decent person with a lot of integrity. So, you know, I grew up in an environment where Democrats and Republicans got along. And for a while, for many years, I was a working journalist. And there are ethical rules around what you can express as a working journalist. And I followed those rules very closely, even though my name wasn't in the paper. I would not put a bumper sticker on my car. I would not donate to a political campaign. I voted, and that was it. So when I got out of that field, I suddenly said, oh, hey, I can do this stuff now. And it was 2007, and I gave my very first political donation of $50 to Hillary Clinton. Well, you can see where that got me. I also – Maine has caucuses, and instead of a presidential primary, although we're changing that. And I spoke for her at the caucus in the town I was living in then, Wells, Maine. And Wells did vote for her, so I felt like I could take some credit there. It was not enough to deliver the state, but, you know, I did my bit. And then the following year I got divorced, and my ex is a Republican and was very active in things like the Chamber of Commerce and the Masons. So I needed something to do that got me out of the house in this little town in Maine where I wasn't going to run into him. And so I started volunteering with the Democrats and got more and more involved with that, discovered I was pretty good at phone banking. And I was active as a volunteer and donor in this last election cycle. I was the treasurer for a local campaign, which did not succeed, unfortunately. And then there was November 8th, and I woke up on November 9th and saw the election result and threw up. So I got together with some other local people who we sort of figured out that we could – there wasn't a whole bunch we could do to change what was happening in Washington, given who had won. There wasn't a whole bunch we could do to change what was happening in the state of Maine, given that we have a lunatic governor. And please see the college system falling apart, et cetera, et cetera. But we could work on making the city of Portland, Maine, a better place. And so we started doing that, and we call ourselves Progressive Portland. And we are doing more concrete political action than this town has seen in a while. We do things like canvassing for the causes we believe in. We do things like polling to see what issues are most important to the voters. We do things like when we have an issue that we care a lot about. We have an issue right now around fixing our crumbling elementary schools. If you look at my Facebook icon, it says protect all four schools. And we've done things like saying we are not going to vote for city council candidates who do not accept fixing all four schools. And this is the city government has been very much an old boys and girls club for a while where nobody really rocked the boat. And so we have taken some flack for this. And, okay, I think this is fun. And it's also, I'm just, as a disabled person, I'm really lucky to live in this time where there's so much I can do without having to leave my house, because I can't leave my house very often. physically can't, and at this point, it's also difficult emotionally.
Didn't you also mention in one of your notes, though, you had sat in at the Senator Collins' office?
I promoted that event, but I didn't go to it. I can't.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I can't risk arrest, because I have responsibilities. I have two cats. And B, because I weigh a lot. I'm very fat. And I think that the effort to move me would not endear me to the police, and I would not be well treated. So I want to do this stuff. Trust me. Oh, I want to with all my heart. Luckily, we had a good turnout for that. So that's my other big issue, is preserving Obamacare, because Obamacare lets me keep working and being independent, even though I rely on a wheelchair or a walker. I don't move around very much, and I have to work from home. I'm able to support myself, pay taxes, contribute to my community, support local businesses. And even if you're a Republican, you should want me doing those things. And Obamacare is the reason why. I make too much money to have a subsidy for my health care. I pay a lot, and I'm really happy to do it because I have access.
Now, Maine's not a small state geographically, but it's not a big state population-wise. How do you explain having, as you mentioned, the lunatic governor and Angus King in the Senate, who became a hero in less 2 weeks? How does that jive?
We are a very interesting state. Senator King often votes with the Democrats, but he is an independent. If
I know
he
that,
had run as a Democrat, it would have been very tough for him to win, especially in the northern part of the state, which is very conservative. The reason that we have a lunatic governor is because there was a spoiler in that race. And I'm not going to talk too much about that because I'll start using bad words. It's tough for the Democratic Party. Portland, where I live, is the liberal center of the state. And once you get out of Portland and into the country, the level of conservatism starts rising sharply. And that's one reason we're trying to get good things done in Portland, because we think there's an audience for this, and we have polling data to back that up. One of the first actions we did, somebody had vandalized a Muslim-owned store downtown, and we organized a shop-in day for the Muslim-owned businesses in town. Now, it's a small town. There are only seven of those businesses. But the mayor got involved. He got the TV cameras there, and it was a big success. I think 1,500 people turned out to shop at these businesses. And, okay, I'm telling you this because it was my idea, and I'm really proud of it.
I'm glad.
I had shawarma for the first time. It was delicious.
That's it's interesting. Now, you mentioned that your father was a moderate Republican, and he and Edmund Rook might have been the last two moderate Republicans in Massachusetts.
He was very fond of Ed Brook.
Susan Collins is considered maybe the last moderate Republican. How did you see her, and what was the sit-in about in her office?
The sit-in was opposing the secret Republican Senate bill to replace Obamacare. And Susan has not been very she tends to be very noncommittal and then at the last minute go along with the party. She knows that there are a lot of vocal and active people in her constituency who oppose the Republican agenda. But she's a Republican. And so she has been kind of playing both sides against the middle for a long time. This is her modus operandi. And I actually made a video for Move On in which I said what I just said to you about how Obamacare lets me vote, participate in my community and stay independent even though I'm disabled.
My
urging her to preserve it, but she, you know, obviously did not respond to that.
Yeah, I grew up, when I first got interested in politics, I came up with this theory, which is totally wrong, because I grew up in the East Coast, the liberal republicanism of Jacob Javits and Nelson Rockefeller, Clifford Case, and John Lindsay. And then we had the conservative Republicans, with Barry Goldwaters and John Towers. And the Democrats had the liberal Democrats, Cubitt Humphrey and the Kennedys. And then they had the conservative ones, who were mainly the Southern racists. Then I said,
yeah,
you know, wouldn't it make sense if we had all the liberals in one party and all the conservatives in the other? And we wound up having that. It was the worst possible thing that could have happened, because people talked about operators. Well, what used to happen was Lyndon Johnson in the Senate and Everett Dirksen on the Republican side, they had to form a consensus within their party, and then they could deal. Now, these people hate each other more and more. They're all in one party. And for a young Republican to be able to move up, they have to go into a primary, and they have to run to the right of the Republican incumbent. And the Democrat has to run to the left of a Democratic incumbent in these gerrymandered districts. And it just gets more and more split, and they get more and more nasty with each other. You know, obviously this past shooting has people talking about unity, but it didn't last.
But
all
not
that
very.
Long.
If Newtown didn't do it.
Yeah, and Gabby Giffins didn't do it. So it's it's difficult. So what else are you going to be doing? Are you writing any political tomes?
I'm not writing a political tome right now. I may after I get my master's thesis done, but that's where I'm focused right now. I'm continuing to work both with Progressive Portland and with other groups. I'm involved with a little local group called Disability Activists and Allies of Maine, and we named it that specifically so that we could say DAMN for the acronym. And we've had some success. We had a meeting with Senator King, not with him personally, but with his health staff, making the case that we wanted him, when he talks about health care, to specifically say people with disabilities, and that he hadn't been doing that. And this was a point that went over well. And the next week, like 4 days later, he gave a speech on the Senate floor in which he specifically talked about people with disabilities and how bad the Republican health bill would be for them, and used photographs of two of the children of our members as examples, young people with disabilities, autism, and a rare genetic disorder, who are not capable of living on their own, but who, with the support that they get from Medicaid, don't have to be completely institutionalized. They can have jobs. They can continue to live somewhat independently. And, you know, if you're the parent of one of these kids, it's absolutely heartbreaking to think that your kid won't get the support he or she needs.
Now, did your governor turn down the Medicaid expansion or not?
He did.
Well, this is going to, if it's properly publicized, and unfortunately, there are so many people that just are too busy in their lives to be concerned with the nuances of any of these bills. Like someone pointed out to me last week, you know, if you're a responsible conservative, you should understand that all the true conservatives like George Will and David Brooks and David Frum have abandoned the president and have gone off on their own. And my answer to that is the average Trump supporter has no idea who George Will is or David Frum.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's not going to make any difference at all. So
can I read a poem? I would like, it's actually relevant to what we were just talking about.
I would love you to read a poem. Whose poem is it?
Her name is Isabel Faith Abbott. You can read more of her stuff at isabelabbott.com. And
okay.
It's about the resistance. Here it is. We need all of us. Not everyone can do everything or do everything all the time. And there are many ways to love and resist, rebel and rise. We need the humans who march in the streets and bang down the doors. We need humans who investigate and report with integrity. We need humans who tend to the sick and the dying. We need humans who drive the safe cars and uphold the strong spaces of sanctuary. We need humans who feed and fuel the uprising. We need humans who call all day, every day, and those who lay their bodies on the ground and say no more. We need humans who hear the confessions and bandage the wounded and use their voice and their power to take a stand. We need humans who are the midwives to the ideas and the maps of unmaking and the babies who will all grow up to become the humans who live here long after we are gone. We need each other. We need organizers and activists. We need the scientists and the educators. We need the parents doing differently and radicals who have always known and show us the way. We need the healers and the agitators, the ones who make the coffee and the ones who write the checks, the ones who open their doors and the ones who tear down the wall. We need the artists who show us what we knew before we knew and say what is unspeakable. We need the lawyers and the writers and the religious and the secularists and the elders and the young. We need the ones who will sing about the dark times and keep singing and singing and singing. We need those who grow things and those who dismantle things and those who say no more. We need those at the protests and those at the pulpits and those in the dark rooms where the subversive shatters our assumptions. We need the lovers, as in actual lovers who touch us in all the places and bring us back into these bodies where we remember again what it is to be human and alive and in those moments not so alone. We need the fighters who stay angry and breathe fire and know there is the here and now and there is the long game and we must fight in and with and for both. We will be asked to give everything, which does not mean we can do everything. We need each other. So in the giving everything, love each other, which is also to love yourself with everything you have.
That's very powerful. If you,
I loved it.
If you send me the link when we talk, when I write the article about this discussion tonight and post the links, I'll include a link to the poem.
Great. Thank you. It spoke to me because there is so much I can't do because of my body. And sometimes it's easy to focus on that and not on what I can do.
That's important, and a lot of us, in time, we try to do too much, and we wind up doing too little because we don't focus on exactly what our strengths are and what our weaknesses are.
Right, and it's a long game. We can't not pace ourselves, or we'll burn out.
On the personal level, you describe yourself as the cat lover. In addition to Fowler the Wonder Dog, we have two cats here, which occupy different parts of the house, and in 39 years here we've had 23 cats, always strays who adopted us for rescue cats. Our current two, Fluffy the Ninja, are just plain wonderful. Tell us about yours.
Felix and Flavia, my ex and I had a tradition of giving our pets ancient Roman names, and these are the last two to be named under that system, because the day after I brought them home as kittens from the shelter, my husband left me. It was an unrelated move. I didn't realize it was going to be a trade. But, you know, the cats have never left dirty socks on the bedroom floor, and they always want to watch the same thing on TV that I do. And Felix is gray with white paws and a little white chest and a white spot on his nose. And Flavia is a tuxedo girl, black with white paws and chest. And they are brother and sister. And when you work from home, it's easy to lose focus, and so they are my supervisors. Flavia in particular gets up on my desk and looks at me like, hey, get to work. You got to buy the cat food, girl.
We've had two tuxedos over the years, and they're both very interesting cats, kind of wild. There was one who came into the house. He died this year at – he was at least 17 because – we're not sure how old he was when I brought him in. And he immediately decided he was never leaving, and he impregnated the female that we hadn't had sex. So that didn't last. He was neutered, but he got what he wanted. So and he was just an extremely interesting cat. And it's interesting because we have one cat who's the rescue who lives in the big room that my wife works in, and when anyone comes to the door, she can't be seen. She's under a bed, and when we were away for a week, the person who came to the house never saw her. She knew that she was there because the litter was dirty and she had eaten, but she never saw her. Whereas this other black cat we have, who's a cat that demanded to come into the house. She was a kitten, and she wouldn't leave, and she finally brought her in, and she's never left. But she's the most affectionate cat, and she followed this woman all around the house, and, you know, she meowed to be petted. So they're extremely different. The other tuxedo that we had, I brought home as to rescue. And we called him the Frenzy because he never stopped. He was always running around the room, and he was always another very interesting cat. Unfortunately, many of our cats, when they've died, have died very expensive deaths, either with a kidney problem or with skin breaking open from their stomachs or other stuff. Some of it's been very tragic, you know. But they're very interesting animals. How many cats in total have you had?
I have had as many as five in the past. I had Zenobia, Kitten of Destiny, who was a black cat. You know how Siamese will sometimes throw a black kitten? So she had the Siamese Meow, and I named her after a warrior queen for a reason. And she lived to be 17, and she was just a grumpy old black cat who hated everybody and barely tolerated me. And I loved her immensely. Felix and Flavia are very social. They got lots and lots of love and attention when they were kittens because I was going through a divorce and I needed it. And so they know the sound the doorbell makes, and one of them will come to the door and act as the greeter. They know when the doorbell goes off that somebody's coming. And because it's tough for me to go out, I frequently have political meetings in my house. And so I have, you know, pictures of the mayor of Portland petting my cats, and my cats have a wide political acquaintance of their own.
That's funny. You have working backgrounds in so many areas, and while you're concentrating on cybersecurity now and on your political activity, is there anything else that's on the agenda that's next for you?
I'm not sure. I have tended not to make really long range plans, and especially now because I'm 52. My mother died at 51, and so I don't really know what you're supposed to do when you're a middle-aged woman. So I get to figure it out. It's going to be fine,
now,
whatever it is.
Now, are there national organizations that support your disability that say coming together as a group, or
yeah,
are you
we have
involved
some,
in any of those?
And then we have Facebook groups. We used to have an email list, but that has largely moved to Facebook. There's actually a conference in the fall. I'm probably not going to go, but they're holding it at Disney, and it's for medical providers and scientists, but also for patients. And one of the reasons they're holding it at Disney is because Disney has a very good track record of catering to people with disabilities. We'll see. I'm going to be in the throes of writing my thesis, so I'm thinking maybe, you know, planning a trip in there is not a great idea, but we'll see.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Patricia Washmer?
I run a Facebook page called Respect because I think it's important to single out people who do good things in the world. And if that is something that interests you, you know, it's not smarmy. It's not just like happy little, you know, inspirational sayings. It's stories about people who are doing something that is worthy of respect.
Okay. That sounds interesting. And it's a Facebook page?
Yep.
And what about your, is there another page that deals with your main resistance, or is that your page itself?
Progressive Portland.
And that's a Facebook one too?
And we also have a website, progressiveportland.com.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Patricia.
Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a good night.
Okay. A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com and publish the daily newsletter mentioned above. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Howie Rose, if the Mets win, and haven't been too many recently, put it in the book. I hope you'll join us next week and every week at 7 p.m. on Sunday nights. And we'll go off peacefully, I hope. I hope tonight.
I like the way sparkling earrings lay against your skin so brown.